Nice and loud. Well, maybe not that loud. Getting over a cold. I might have made a strategic mistake this morning. Usually I come pretty early Sunday mornings to preach through my sermon, and I did twice, but because I'm recovering from a cold, I only have so much voice, and I find myself wishing for maybe not 1,000 tongues, but maybe just one more to get me through today's lesson. So we're continuing. Actually, we're getting close. We're kind of entering into the home stretch of this series, James, Faith That Grows. And I've enjoyed it. It's been challenging for me, and I hope it's been good for you as well. Just kind of to give you a heads up, this next week, I won't be here. Mike's going to be preaching for us. And Alicia and I are going to a retreat for ministers and their wives for Churches of Christ in the Pacific Northwest. So we get to head up to the Cannon Beach area and spend some time with some other ministers and their wives, and we're looking forward to that. And our girls and Chai will remain here. Thank you for you folks who are helping look after them. And then after I get back, I think we'll have maybe 1 or 2 weeks where we'll wrap up this series on James. And then from there, I might like to talk a little bit about some ecclesiology, what it means to be a church. What does God desire from the church? What should a church look like? And then once we round the holiday season, we're going to slide into January. And the plan then is to get into wonderful words of love from the Gospel of John. And that should carry us well through the spring. I think John has just got some amazing stuff, and I'm really looking forward to that as well. So let's jump into our text this morning. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. So let me recap a little bit. Maybe you remember something of our discussion from a couple weeks back from James chapter 3. We talked about two kinds of wisdom, the wisdom from God and the wisdom of this world. The wisdom of this world being earthbound. It takes God out of the equation. This universe is a closed system of just random chance. So when we take God out of the equation, then of course the problem is there's not enough to go around. Not everybody is going to get their fair share. And this is what leads to fights and quarrels, this scarcity mentality. But as an alternative to quarreling and fighting, James tells us to pray. Prayer. And then he told us that a lot of times our prayers, they end up not going anywhere. We've all felt this before. And the problem is that the heart behind the prayers that are lifted up is not right. Because even in prayer, we struggle to have our own selfish way. James calls this kind of thinking adultery. He had hard words for us last week. But taking this further, James shows us the secret to making our prayers more effective. The secret to an effective prayer life: submission to the will of God in humility. That's the secret right there. So now in chapter 4, 11 and 12, he gives the first of three examples of earthly wisdom or earthbound wisdom. The first being trying to control our brothers and sisters through negative forms of speech. He talks about slander, he talks about speaking against, and he talks about judging. Who are you to judge? These things, slander, speaking against, and judging, are ways that we try to manage people around us, are they not? And so that's one example of earthbound wisdom. So now in today's text, chapter 4, 13 and 14, he's talking about another instance of earthbound wisdom that creeps into our thinking. He's speaking specifically to businessmen and women, but more generally, he's talking about the manner in which we go about to make plans. especially making plans without regard to God in any way. So here's our business plan, our long-term plans, our strategic plans. We're going to go to this place. We're going to make a whole lot of money. This is what's going to happen. Who is the last one who has entered into our thinking? Who is the last one we've decided that we needed to consult in that? A lot of times, God gets put at the end of that list, unfortunately. It's unfortunate not for God, it's unfortunate for us. And that's not to say it's a mistake. Don't take this text as a saying it's a mistake to make long-range plans or to think strategically or to set goals. Those are actually really important things to do, and they're good, godly things to do. They are a sign of wisdom. But what James is talking about here is making all of these plans with the idea that we are in control of these things. You do not control your future. You are a vapor, a mist, some little cloud that floats around for a little while, and then you're going to be gone. You're going to be gone. That's the truth of it. You do not control anything. Take that to heart. Think about that. That's a beginning to teach you wisdom, relinquishing your need to control situations around you. All right. So this question we have about life plans from this text, I think we can ask, how is my life honoring God? How are the plans that you have put in place, how are they blessing your neighbor? Your goals that you've set for yourself, what are they doing for the good of this church? What are they doing to help your brothers and sisters in Christ? Or is it clear from the way you live your life and the plans that you've made that you're really just looking out for number one? That's a tough question. James is inviting us to ask some tough questions. So he goes on to say in verse 15 through 17, instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag. All such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do it and doesn't do it sins. And once again, James is not telling us don't make plans. He's telling us make space to accept the will of God. Do you want a life of power and purpose and joy? You can nod your head. Yes, I want that. Then align your plans with God's plans. Because in the end, God is going to get his outcomes. His desires will be fulfilled. He will be successful. James talks about boasting being evil. As we read last week, James 4:6 says, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Have you made room for the will of God in your plans? In your life goals, your strategic goals, your financial goals, your relational goals, your business goals, whatever, your having fun kind of goals, have you made room for God in any of those things? So then the question, of course, is, well, Calvin, how do we go about doing that then? If you're going to push us on that, what are your suggestions? Please be helpful. It's not hard. The way you align yourself, your plans with God's plans, you find something that is close to the heart of God. And you invest in it. You bless it. You serve. You see, what are things that are close to God's heart? Your relationship with your neighbor, it matters to God. This church is important to God. The poor and the marginalized, those who don't have voices of their own, they are important to God. They matter to God. Relationship is very important to God. Have you gotten to know God through your prayer life is a question you can ask. Because that's how we get to know God. That's how we build a relationship with God, is through prayer. You find things that are important to God, and you invest in them. That's how you align your plans. And this takes intentionality, because it involves both time and commitment. It will involve resources. It will involve all of your relationships. But if you want to have a life of power and purpose, enjoy a life that blesses others, a life that's not just bowed down under the weight of selfishness. If you want to have a life of purpose and power, align your plans with God's plans. Because in the end, he's the only one who controls the future. James uses this phrase, anyone then who knows the good he ought to do, doesn't do it, sins. So let me unpack that a little bit for us. There are some translation difficulties here in this passage, but it is clear that this is still a situation in which knowledge is not matched up to appropriate action. And that's what James is all about, is not just a faith that knows something, but a faith that acts. So this is a situation where a person knows something good and they've recognized it to be good, and yet they refuse to do anything about it. The refusal to take action. The refusal to do the thing that God is calling you to. James calls that sin. That's tough words. All right, well, what is the good? Refusing to do the good. That good in this context, what is that? He refers to this in 4:17 there. Well, in this context, it refers to being prayerful about making your plans, about working together with God in the goals that you're setting, the things that you want to do with your future. Do the plans you have set your heart on, did they align with the will of God as you understand the will of God? And then he gets even more pointed and harsh. Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted, and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. This is talking about the perils of lusting after wealth. To the extent you love your wealth, it correlates to how much you love God. Your wealth doesn't want to share you with God, and God doesn't want to share you with your wealth. And yet, that's a fine line we Christians are always trying to walk. Because God knows when you fall in love with money, you inevitably will fall out of love with God. Or again, because of our double-mindedness, because we want to hold on to God, but yet there's a certain pull that this financial security has for me. Because we try to hold on to both of these multiple loves, it's a double-minded state, what James calls split-souled state where your heart is set on multiple things. Because of that, we never progress very far in what the love of God really can do for us. Because when we try to hold on to multiple things, our mind, it's a schizophrenic mind. We can't do both. And we never learn the lessons we have to learn by only having the Lord to cling to. If you've not learned to cling to God exclusively, I know we've not progressed very far in intimacy with God. There are depths to the love of God and power in that love that we've only skimmed the surface of. Well, the tendency of wealth is, we think of it as offering some kind of security for us. And when you look to your wealth exclusively for security, then we know that we have to have it. And we also know we have to get it to be secure. And so inevitably, other humans, when they come along, they will get in the way of our accumulating more wealth. Other people will get in the way of us holding on to and keeping our wealth, which leads to broken relationships, leads to alienation. These are some of the themes that James is touching on here in all of this. But in the end, how very fragile is both wealth and all the manifestations of it if we try to hold on to those apart from God. He says, your gold and silver are corroded. That's a rather striking image, because in the ancient world, silver and gold were precious precisely because they didn't corrode easily. They resisted corrosion. This would have been well known to James. And that makes me think that the corrosion he's talking about is larger than just physical deterioration of this particular manifestation of wealth. He's talking about what happens in the human heart. James uses courtroom language as well. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. That's courtroom language. And what he's doing here, in essence, is he's taking this language and he's reversing a situation that we already read about in chapter 2, verse 6, in which the rich were the ones dragging the poor into courts and causing them trouble. Remember reading that in chapter 2, verse 6? It is the rich who are oppressing. It's the rich who are slandering the noble name of him to whom you belong. And so now we have this great reversal here in this image he's painting for us. Now it's no longer the poor who are in the dock. It is the rich who are on trial. They're the ones who have to answer for things. All right, look. The wages you failed to pay, the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on the earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you. Again, we see earthbound wisdom at work here. The wisdom that takes God out of the equation. If I love wealth and I do not know the love of God, the logical conclusion of this is that I will cheat people, I'll steal from them, I will exploit them, I will use other human beings like a commodity. And then I will be completely blind to the suffering that I have caused, to any collateral damage I have made, because I'm too busy wallowing in my own luxury and selfish fulfillment. Once again, in a closed universe where there is no God, where if I'm going to take care of myself, I may have to stomp on a few throats. The logical conclusion of this kind of thinking is going to lead you to a place where condemnation and murder are normal and even acceptable at times, even with those who are innocent, because they got in my way. This is a hard teaching that James is presenting us with. I think in the entire book, these words that he uses in relationship to people who are rich are the harshest words. Chapter 4 is tough in a lot of ways. And so I don't want to blunt that. So the question we need to ask then for ourselves is, does my bank account reflect the fact that I love Jesus, or does my bank account reflect the fact that I love myself? Let's get real here. Let me look at your credit card statement. Let me look at your checkbook. Because it'll show me a little picture, at least, of something about what your priorities in life are like. And it'll betray where your heart truly lies. So I think the struggle for us is not to just dismiss the hardship of this text in James. Let it speak to you. Now let me say about wealth in general. James is dealing with a specific situation of wealthy people who are exploiting others. And also keep in mind, the Bible has a bigger theology of wisdom regarding having and using wealth. A lot of times our wealth comes to us as a gift from God, and He expects us to use it in ways that honor Him. And I don't think the answer He's asking for here is to just get rid of everything and walk away. No, we're called to stewardship as well. The Bible talks a lot about that. But let's not try to swerve around things too quickly. Let's just be uncomfortable in this text for a minute. Because one of the vices that churches have failed to address, we failed to root this out in our midst, is the vice of greed. I've heard churches rebuke people for just about every sin I can think of or imagine. But I've never heard of anyone being confronted by their church because they were greedy. Now, my experience is limited. I recognize that. But greed, I think, is very often the idol that we have left untouched in our lives. So, James gives us a description of three incidents of earthly wisdom. And these things are manifestations of arrogance. The first one from 4:11, slandering and judging a neighbor. Number two, pretentious boasting that tomorrow's activities can be secured without reference to God. I'll just go this place, I'll make this money, I'll just do this, this will be great. Number three, living luxuriously upon the earth while simultaneously condemning the innocent, from James chapter 5, verse 5 and 6. All of these activities are concrete examples of things that will make God your opponent. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. All right, let's move on. So now James has us shift gears a bit. And we move the discussion now to patience in suffering. Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. You too be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against each other, brothers, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. James is teaching us another secret about the wisdom that is from above, wisdom from God. Godly wisdom is patient. Godly wisdom is patient. And for many of us, this is going to be the hardest lesson we have to learn. The lesson of waiting upon the Lord. It's a tough one for me. Trust that the Lord will act on your behalf. Trust it. Your task is to be patient and to pray. The task of patience is prayer. And this isn't just a do-nothing patience that he's talking about here, where we just sit there and twiddle our thumbs. Waiting upon the Lord is active patience. It's active, the way faith is active. I always found this verse to be a huge encouragement, and I really love it. But they that wait... They that what? Wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up on wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. From Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31. The whole point of the book of James is that faith is active. Patiently waiting on the Lord is active. Prayer is a big part of our waiting on the Lord. And Lord willing, a couple weeks from now, we're going to be looking at what James' teaching is on ways that we are active when we are waiting on the Lord later on in chapter 5. So also from the text that we just had, let me try to back it up. Also in this text, if you look through three different times, James refers, in just these couple verses here, three different times, he's referred to in some way to the Lord's coming, the second coming. And I just wanted to comment on that because I think it's significant. I suspect that James is meaning more than just the second coming of Christ. I think he means that, but I think he means more than that. He's also referring to any time the Lord shows up in a big way in your life. And the Greek that is used here, in which this is translated from, is not just the Lord's being near temporally, but also the nearness of the Lord spatially. He's not just near time-wise, he's near to me where he's standing. So just like in 5:9, we read that the judge is standing at the door. He's just on the other side of the door. While you're complaining about your brother and sister in Christ, he's right on the other side of that door listening to you do that. So the Lord's deliverance on your behalf for those who wait upon them, those who wait upon the Lord, his deliverance for you, it's just over the horizon. It's just around the corner. It's imminent. His rescue mission on your behalf has already been launched. That's the way that we're supposed to believe. That's the way we're supposed to have faith and trust in that. And then they also say, he uses this farming imagery. If you want to receive the crops, if you want to receive the crops, and you want to receive the crops, just so you know, you're going to have to be patient through the rains. You will not become fully the man or woman God that God intended you to be without struggle along the way. James has already taught us that the testing of your faith produces endurance, perseverance. And let me also say that in the economy of God, the value of the produce always justifies the wait. The answers God has for your issue, whatever those issues are, your plans, whatever those plans are, his answers are always going to be better than anything that you can come up with on your own without regard for him. They're always going to be better. And then he says this word, too, at the end of this, in verse 9 here. Don't grumble against each other, brothers, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. I think what he's pointing out, especially when it comes to perseverance and issues of patience, when is the time that you're most likely going to grumble? It's probably going to be the time that you're being forced to wait in some way. That you're being forced to be patient by some situation and you're very uncomfortable. That's the time when you're most likely going to grumble, is it not? Think about that. It is for me anyway. I get hangry. It's been a little while since, you know, I ate. And, you know, my wife was just gone for 3 weeks and I had to figure this all out on my own, and somehow I survived, and I'm just as fat as I was before. But anyway, I can tend to get a little cranky sometimes when I don't get things my way right away. Don't grumble. Don't do it. Just let go of that. Just own it for what it is and let that thing go. Hand that over to the Lord too. And when you fall and when you make mistakes, you repent and you move on. That's what we need to do. Brothers, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. So he has given us three examples here in James of patience. Number one, the analogy of a farmer waiting for their crop. Number two, the Old Testament prophets. Just for example, Jeremiah had to preach for 40 years with no results. Nobody came forward in 40 years. I've already had like four people in 2 months. Sorry, I'm trying to be funny again. I'm not very good at it. Maybe it's the sick, this cold thing. But anyway, you get what you get. Don't throw a fit. All right, number three, the story of Job. 3,000 years later, we still receive encouragement from Job for his refusal to curse God, his refusal to say that God is evil. He wouldn't do it. His wife said, curse God and die. It's enough already. Just give up. He is an example that James uses of perseverance. So let me say a word about these Old Testament prophets. We don't really know who they are, but very likely James has in mind prophets like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, maybe Hosea. And they were true prophets in the minds of the Jewish people. They were true prophets precisely because of the hardships that they had to patiently endure, especially those incidents of constantly being rejected, of not being heard by the people they were sent to give this message to. Situations where the wisdom and friendship of the world, it just couldn't sustain them because all they were getting was ridicule and judgment. Sit down already. Be quiet. You're making me uncomfortable. Go away. All they had left. Hello, Lord. The only thing strong enough for them to continue to face this kind of persecution, what is that? They had to rely on God. They had to make God their friend. And only in that kind of intimacy and that kind of friendship will you be able to persevere when other people say bad things against you. Also, when people praise you. Praise is dangerous for us too sometimes. When we begin to think we get a big head and we're doing something apart from God. I did this in my own strength, in my own power. Friendship with the Lord will save you from that. All right. So, James says that the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. He tells us first that you can be patient. For what reason? Because the Lord is near. He's near in time. He's near in location. He's near. He's right there. So you can patiently wait on him. And here's the second reason he gives us why we can have patience and wait for the Lord's answers. The Lord is compassionate. God is merciful. His answers, they are coming. We know that his answers are going to be mercy on your behalf. God does not delight in our suffering. God does not delight in the things that cause us pain. He is compassionate, and his compassion, the compassion of God, will move him into powerful action on your behalf if you wait upon the Lord. If you trust in the Lord and lean not on your own understanding, if you find the commands of God and you build your plans to parallel his plans, his compassion will, for you, will move him to action. So a faith that grows is a faith that knows God is close by. His justice is at hand. He has already launched his rescue mission on your behalf, and it's coming soon. A faith that grows is a faith that shows patient endurance because the Lord is compassionate and merciful. His answers to your problems are the answers that you really need. A faith that grows is a faith that goes to do your part and with excellence. Active patience, patiently waiting, enduring. To wait upon the Lord doesn't mean we sit there and twiddle our thumbs waiting for some divine whammy to hit us. No, you do your part with excellence. And then for those things that are beyond your wisdom or control, you wait patiently, a waiting that is characterized by the work of prayer. Prayer is a key for us. All right, one last story, and we'll finish our time together this morning. Here's this fine gentleman there. He's painted there, in older in life. Any of you recognize him? You probably haven't seen him regularly. And how accurate can it be? It was with a paintbrush, you know. So the man in this painting, he would seem an unlikely vessel for confronting a great societal evil of his time. But through patience and perseverance over the course of his entire lifetime, God used him. He was born in 1759 to a wealthy merchant class family, and he was described as a child as a small, sickly, delicate child with poor eyesight. When he was 9 years old, his father died, and his mother, who was struggling to cope with the loss, it was decided by the family that the young boy should go live with his aunt and uncle. And he grew extremely fond of this aunt and uncle. His aunt, Hannah, was an evangelical Christian, a supporter of the preacher George Whitefield. And she began to disciple her young nephew. Well, when his mother and grandfather heard about this, they were staunch Anglicans. They didn't like these nonconformist Christian beliefs of this other side of the family. When they began to hear about their influences over the boy, they decided to take him back, and they moved him, now he was 12 years old, to his grandfather's house in Hull, England. Well, he had been influenced, even as a young boy up to the age of 12, by these Methodist scruples of what it means to be a Christian. And initially, he resisted the social life that he was immersed in now. But as his religious fervor began to diminish, as often happens for a lot of teenage boys or girls, as that began to diminish, he began to pour himself into things like going to the theater, attending balls, and playing cards, which had different connotations then than they do now. In October of 1776, at the age of 17, our young man went to college at St. John's in Cambridge. And the death of his grandfather and uncle in 1777 had left him independently wealthy. And as a result, he had little inclination or need to apply himself seriously in his studies. Instead, he immersed himself in his social life and pursued hedonistic living, enjoying cards and gambling and late-night drinking sessions. He finally did manage to complete a bachelor's and then a master's degree. And then while he was still a student at 21 years age, he used the family fortune and he managed to get himself elected as a member of the British Parliament. He attended Parliament regularly, but he also maintained a very lively social life, becoming a regular at gentlemen's gambling clubs. He was described by some of his peers as the wittiest man in England and was also recognized to have a great singing voice. In February of 1785, through the influence of a friend and a religious book that he was reading, faith was somehow rekindled in his soul. He started to get up early in the morning before the sun came up to read his Bible and to pray, and he kept a private journal of his relationship with God. He gave himself fully to the Lord and repented of his past life, and he resolved to commit his future life to and work to the service of God. And he did this in a time where religious enthusiasm was generally regarded as a social transgression by polite society. And this is what often happens in polite society, in political circles, in highly educated circles. Ardent devotion to Jesus Christ, it's politically incorrect. It's in poor taste. There were a few snickers and a few jeers when he would walk into a room. But his faith was sincere, and his faith, it grew. And he was soon to find the work of his lifetime. Some of you may have already figured out who I'm talking about. I'm talking about William Wilberforce, who would become the voice of the abolitionist movement within the British Empire. Wilberforce's involvement in the abolition movement was motivated by a desire to put his Christian principles in action and to serve God in public life. He and other evangelicals were horrified at what they perceived was a depraved and unchristian trade, and the greed and avarice of the owners and the traders. Wilberforce sensed a calling from God. He wrote these words in his journal entry from 1787. God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of moral values. So from that time in 1787, that's when he was first involved with the abolitionist movement, Wilberforce, he faced defeat after defeat after defeat in any parliamentary hearings that he was a part of. He learned that those who were involved with the slave industry, they had very deep pockets, and they were able to buy all the political support that they needed. He also learned that public opinion is very fickle, and things like the war with France would put the anti-slavery movement on the back burner for years at a time. But he kept at it. In defeat after defeat, he held his faith that this was what God wanted him to do. He didn't let go. He wouldn't just let the issue slide. It would take him a full 20 years before he would have his first success. And that success was the passage of the Slave Trade Act of 1807. Well, in later years, Wilberforce supported the campaign for the complete abolition of slavery and continued his involvement after 1826. 1826 is when he was forced to resign from Parliament because of his failing health. But he kept supporting abolition. And the campaign that he was involved with finally led to the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, which abolished slavery throughout the British Empire, which led to the freeing of millions of men, women, and children. Wilberforce, he died just 3 days after hearing that the passage of the Slavery Abolition Act was going to pass through Parliament. William Wilberforce's patience, persistence, and stubborn faith were a living example of what James talks about in chapter 5, verse 7 and 8, when he says, "Be patient, then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming." See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crops. And how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. If you believe that, it's amazing what you can endure. And it's amazing what you can accomplish through the Lord working in your life. So I don't know what your needs are this morning. As always, you have opportunity to put the Lord on in baptism, to ask for the prayers of this church. You can let us know. You come forward while we stand and sing, and we'll help you any way we can. Thank you.